Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 2nd, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Esther Men. Today's session number is 98.2, and it's titled Genesis Chapter 18, Abraham and Sarah Entertain Guests. This session is the first in a series of four based on the theme Eating Together, Stories of Hospitality and Hope. Let's listen in.
My name is Esther Mann, and today we're going to start a study of a series of Bible passages that depict eating together. They're stories of hospitality and hope. And two are from the Old Testament and two from the New Testament. We're starting today with the story of Abraham and Sarah and their entertainment of the three guests that arrived at their tent. This series I thought would be appropriate because Holden is such a welcoming place, ideally a welcoming place and a place that shows hospitality to all people. And Abraham, as the father of our faith, is a wonderful exemplar of that kind of welcoming. So that's the reason that I start with this particular story. So why don't we turn to Genesis 18, and you'll notice that in the very first verse it says, the Lord appeared to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre as he sat at the entrance of his tent. So there he is at the oaks of Mamre. You might want a little refresher about what he did before he got there, sort of where we are in his story. This chapter is happening after he has been received the call to leave his homeland. His family's already traveled from Ur, the Chaldeans, which is in modern-day Iraq, it's the Persian Gulf. They've traveled a long distance and they've gone to Haran, which is in Syria. So they've already made a big journey. And now he's called to leave his family, too, and go to a place that he's never been. And he does that. He's given promises. He's told that he's going to become a father of a great nation. He's told that he's going to, that his descendants will inherit a land and that he will be traveling in during his life. And he's also told that the family will receive blessings. So those are the three promises that he's given. And at a couple of points in chapters 15 and 17, God makes a covenant with him. Covenant meaning a binding relationship, a kind of pact. And he once again reiterates those three promises of descendants, land, and a blessing for his family, and also that his family will be a blessing to all the families of the nation. The other parts of the story that have gone on before this involves, in most cases, threats to those promises. So it sort of increases the tension. You wonder, you know, what's going to happen. So for example, as soon as he receives these promises and he's told to go to the land, in that same chapter, in chapter 12, there's a famine in the land. He has to leave the land. So he gets there only to leave and to go down to Egypt. And there, Sarah is incorporated into the royal harem because they lie and they say that Sarah is actually the sister of Abraham and so forth. Well, so now it looks like you don't even have the mother of the nation. So there's a possibility there's going to be a wrong father there. But they get out of that one and actually come away from Egypt with much wealth and cattle, gold, and so forth. So he and his family prosper. There's also problems. He has problems with his nephew Lot. There's a lot of disagreement about the land, herding their flocks, and there's problems with the well, water rights, and so forth in the land. And so Abraham offers Lot any lands he chooses, and he chooses the best land, which is towards Sodom and Gomorrah, which doesn't turn out very well. But it looks like at that time that Lot gets the better land. But God tells Abraham, don't worry, he had good land too. There's also problems with the local kings. There's a war that goes on, but Abraham's able to prevail. And then the big problem is that Sarah never has any children. She's barren, the idea being that the father provided the seed and the mother provided a sort of a house or a, you know, protected place for the seed to grow. And so that's why that the term barren is referred to. You refer to fields as barren too, because they can't support, you know, the life that's given to them in the seed. So this is a big problem, and they try to solve this by bringing in the surrogate mother, Hagar, but that's not to be the way of the promise. So this has all happened by the time we see Abraham sitting by the oaks of Mamre, the heat of the day. So he's had quite an active life, moved around a lot. Even when he's been in the land, I should mention, he's lived at Bethel, he's lived at Shechem, Bethel, he's lived in Beersheba, now he's at the Oaks of Mamre in Hebron. This man has moved around a lot. He's seen a lot of hardship in his own life, and still he's without children. So there he is. So why don't we read this part, 18:1-8. If somebody would read that, would you like to read that for us?
Certainly.
And can you tell us what translation you're using, just so that...
The New Revised Standard.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The Lord appeared to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre as he sat at the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day. He looked up and saw three men standing near him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent entrance to meet them and bowed down to the ground. He said, "My Lord, if I find favor with you, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. Let me bring a little bread that you may refresh yourselves, and after that you may pass on, since you have come to your servant." So they, how far did you want?
Why don't you just read on to 8, and then we'll go back verse by verse.
So they said, "Do as you have said." And Abraham hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, "Make ready quickly 3 measures of choice flour, knead it, and make cakes." Abraham ran to the herd and took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the servant who hastened to prepare it. Then he took curds and milk and the calf that he had prepared and set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree while they ate.
All right, thank you very much. All right, this is a rather mysterious opening, isn't it? The Lord appeared to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre. And you'll notice in your Bibles, most likely you have "Lord" in small caps. Do you see that? It's sort of an odd print. Maybe this is repetition for some of you, but this is the way that English convention often indicates the divine name Yahweh. Excuse me for pronouncing it, but anyway, it was never pronounced after a while to show respect for the deity. And so it was written with the letters Yod, He, Vav, He, or Y, W, H, W. Yeah, it was probably pronounced Yahweh. But after a time, it was never pronounced, but instead, the word Lord, Adonai, was pronounced, wherever that tetragrammaton, the four-letter name of God, appeared. So the Hebrew word Adonai, or Lord, was substituted just as a way of respecting God's glory. The name was so sacred that it wasn't even spoken. So anyway, so when you see that in the small caps, then there's actually a proper name behind that, but that just isn't pronounced anymore. If you see translations such as the King James that have the name Jehovah, or the Jehovah's Witnesses also say, you know, that we know the name of God, Jehovah. That's very interesting, because that's combining the consonants of Yahweh with the vowels of Adonai, the consonants of Yahweh, the name, with the vowels of the word Lord. Because what they did was they took the consonants of Yahweh, but didn't put in the vowels for Yahweh, put in the vowels for Lord, Adonai, because you're supposed to always pronounce it Lord. So Jehovah is actually a kind of a combination of the two words. So when you hear it, it's an interesting development that we have in the history of God's name. So here we have the Lord appearing to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre. Abraham's often associated with trees. Have you noticed that? He always settles by the oak of Moreh in 12:16. So it may be a pleasant place to live, but also this word that's translated as oaks, it's probably better translated as terebinths. I don't know exactly what kind of tree that is, but I know it's not an oak. But when the English translators translated into oak, it's because the oak was a sacred tree for the Druids and other people in England. So they tried to get sort of that sense of what a sacred tree would be in English. So there he is sitting. Now, I have a couple questions for you. Maybe we can talk this through. First of all, does Abraham, we know that the Lord appeared to Abraham, right? Because we're told that right away. But does Abraham know that it's the Lord that's appearing to him? Does he have any clue that he's going to be entertaining divinity? And when, you say no, and when do you think, does he ever become aware of it during that passage? Is there any indication? Or tell me why you say no first. I think you're right.
He prepares the meal as he would for anybody of a high standing within their community.
As if he had...
if it was a Lord, yes, if he knew it was a Lord, I think he'd be thunderstruck, perhaps. Unable to move.
Or maybe he would have offered a sacrifice or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But when he bowed to them, he said, "If I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord."
Mm-hmm.
As if he was talking to them.
Right. Okay, now that's interesting. Now look here, there's a clue here. You have a very good point, because you might, those are things that we would associate with worshiping a divinity. Now, when we look at, let's look at the words here. He said, "My Lord." Now look how that's not in those small caps. So that's giving you a hint that it's not the tetragrammaton or the actual name of God, Yahweh, that's indicated there, but it's just the polite address, you know, like sir, that kind of thing.
Why would he use singular there instead of saying to all three?
You have a good point there. You have three men standing. This is the other question that I want to ask you is who? Is the Lord here?
Who's the two?
Is it the three altogether? Is it one of them, and he's accompanied by two companions? So there's a related question: is who is this Lord, and how is the Lord being depicted here? It's rather confusing and vague, and I think maybe intentionally. But just let's save this for 1 minute while we go back to your very good observation that he bows down to him, because that's a good observation there. Might be a clue. We find that people do bow down to other people in the Bible. So, for example, when Jacob's returning to his brother Esau, and they've been through a lot. Jacob's ripped Esau off a couple of times, and Esau's wanted to kill him. So he's going back together. And he's made all these preparations. This is in Genesis 32. Jacob's coming back to his brother, trying to win his favor. By giving him, he sends ahead a lot of livestock. And he's a bit of a coward, so he divides his children up and sends them on ahead first, and then his wives and so forth. Finally, he meets up with his brother face to face after all these years. This is in 33:3. 33:3.
and says, he himself went on ahead of them. Bowing himself to the ground seven times until he came near his brother. Actually, excuse me, he leads his children in there. He's not that much of a coward. But okay, so he bows down to his brother seven times there. So people do bow down to other people toward the ground if they're honoring them or if they are trying to win their favor. Something like that. So he's definitely giving these people a lot. He doesn't even know them, who they are, where they come from, anything, but yet he's giving them that kind of honor, bowing down to the ground. He doesn't even ask, well, who are you, where are you from, what's your business, are you honest people, are you honest? He doesn't ask any questions, does he? He just runs and bows down. Okay. That was an excellent observation, Lana. Can you get up? Okay.
We'll keep this question about when he learns that maybe they're more than ordinary visitors in our minds as we read on, because I think there's some clues later on that they're more than just people, and it doesn't tell us when he becomes aware, but maybe we can discern that. Mm-hmm. Then the other question that was raised here is a really good one, is who is this Lord? There's three men walking. And
Father, Son, Holy Spirit?
Yeah, Christians from the time of Irenaeus on to Martin Luther have seen this as sort of a sign of the Trinity, because he speaks in the singular, and yet there are three. It looks in the context of the Hebrew Bible, it may be that in the original creation story, the first creation story, when God makes humankind in his own image and likeness, that they may have been more literal about that than we are at this point, because in the later on you have God walking, remember, in the cool of the night in Genesis 3, and asking, well, Adam, where are you, and so forth. He's walking in the cool of the night as a human being would. Here there's these men walking. Later Jacob, in the same scene actually, before he meets his brother Esau, he fights with a man, it says a man, Ish, I mean that's just the name for man, and when he prevails, this figure renames him Israel. Jacob becomes Israel because he has fought with God fought with God and prevailed. So it seems that man somehow embodies divinity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, an angel is an interpretation, one interpretation of that. Now, as we go on, we're going to see that the men move on, and yet the Lord remains with Abraham. It doesn't say how many of the men moved on, if all of them moved on, and the Lord remained. But look at 19, the beginning of 19. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening. So there it seems that you have two angels and the Lord being accompanied by with those two angels. It's vague. I mean, it's a difficult passage if you try to look at it, just how they are envisioning God's presence, how God is acting in history in this kind of human form. I don't think that they're making any kind of claim that God is sort of constrained to a human form here or anything like that, but they're talking about God's involvement here with Abraham in a very concrete way. Do you have any other observations or anything about that?
Well, in verse 22 of chapter 18, the Amplified Bible reads, now the two men turned from there and went toward Sodom, But Abraham still stood before the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be an indication that the Lord and two others
mm-hmm.
were the three, because it's related to the same passage.
Yeah, that's the Amplified Bible?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think what they're doing is that they are taking the indication in chapter 19, the two angels, and they're putting that the word two mm-hmm. in there.
Yeah, it's in brackets.
Uh-huh. So making that a sort of an interpretation of the whole thing, that it was the Lord with two angels. And actually in the Psalms, sometimes you see the Lord accompanied by things like fire and flame, so with two servants. So that would be a traditional way of a royal, a person to travel would be with two attendants, one on either side, right? So that would be a very lovely image as well, to have the two servants or messengers on the side, and they go ahead to do his work in Sodom and Gomorrah, and he remains there while they're speaking together. Okay, but I think that it's true that early on he just sees three men. He looks up and saw three men standing near him. The Hebrew is the Hebrew narrative style is very very terse, I guess. It doesn't really tell what's his reaction. You know, it doesn't say, "Oh, he was surprised," or "He was glad to see them," or you know, it doesn't give his internal reaction. You have to read the verbs, and you have to read what he says to kind of get the inner psychology, how he's feeling, how he's reacting. So what kind of indications do we have here in the language?
Well, in the Amplified, again, it says he ran from the tent door to meet them.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. He ran. Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's in all of ours. So kept that. So he ran from the tent entrance to meet them. And he sees them. And he bows down to them once again. I mean, that's rather excessive.
To the ground,
right. Before he even, you know, asks them any questions or anything, he bows down to the ground. And immediately he offers them
to wash their feet.
Wash their feet, yeah. Give them a little water, wash their feet, and for them to rest themselves. And then he wants to give them a little bread to refresh themselves. So immediately he offers them all these comforts that they would need in the desert. It's like they're passing through the desert, a very dry place.
You know, he didn't know who they were. The only thing he could judge them as far as station would be their attire
mm-hmm.
and how they came
mm-hmm.
by camel or horse or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's another curious thing is that he's sitting there at the entrance of the tents and he looks up and they're there. There's no, that's sort of part of their mysteriousness, right? Right. That's another aspect of their mysteriousness. Also, all of a sudden they're there. And it doesn't give you any indication of, you know, and they were there and they were in costly clothing or anything like that. But you can imagine that.
Yeah.
You could imagine that. But it's interesting how you can see how little the Hebrew text gives you actually, and it sort of makes you use your imagination
right.
and your interpretive skills. Right.
If they were staying there and no footprints lead to that spot, that'd be a rather awesome
right.
point.
It doesn't even say that, does it? Just leave that up.
And he asks them to stay, so they evidently didn't indicate that they were coming to stay
mm-hmm.
when they were first approached, because he asks them to stay.
Mm-hmm. And he says, if I find favor with you, do not pass by your servant.
Mm-hmm.
Look at those words. He's already bowed down to them, indicating that he's elevating them in status, mm-hmm. right? He's running to them, bowing down to the ground. And then he says, if I find favor in your eyes, mm-hmm. then stay with me, stay with your servant, right? So he's really...
He's putting ownership there, actually, isn't he?
That he is theirs?
That he's theirs.
At your service, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He's showing how humble Abraham was.
Mm-hmm.
He's very humble. Person in this passage.
Mm-hmm. You're right, and to think that he is he's a very wealthy man.
Yeah, he was the leader in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And not, he wasn't called a king, but he was probably the equivalent of king in mm-hmm. that little area. Mm-hmm. And here he is being very humble to these mm-hmm. uninvited guests.
Mm-hmm. Uninvited guests, this is a good way of looking at it too. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he offers them all these things, water in the desert, and you can imagine how welcome that would be, washing the feet after a long journey, it'd be very dirty, and for rest under the tree. So he offers his tree and a little food before they pass on. Since you've come to your servant, now he's using that again, offering himself as the servant here. And they accept. Do as you said. Notice then that it continues, and he keeps running, right? So look at some of these verbs. Mm-hmm. So you don't get any kind of confirmation that he was very eager to, you know, there's no aside saying he was very eager to please them or he wanted to do this because, you know, whatever reason, but it just keeps on going. He hastened into the tent to Sarah, and he said, make ready quickly 3 measures of choice flour. 3 measures, that's, these are...
At mine it says, seeds.
Saya?
Uh-huh. Sayas, and then in the little footnote it said, that's about 20 quarts. So about 22 liters.
22 liters, uh-huh.
So that's a lot of flour.
24. Yeah. That's a lot of flour.
Uh-huh.
Yes, it shows his generosity. And it's not only flour of any kind, right, but choice flour, right? So finely ground flour. So that's a lot of food that he's preparing for these 3 unexpected guests. And notice it contrasts with what he said earlier. He says, let me bring you a little bread that you may refresh yourself, right? It's the little bread. And so he runs to Sarah and he says, quick, make up, you know, this huge amount, batch of bread, right? And then, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Then he has them kill a calf and prepare it. This would have taken a considerable amount of time. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something that he could just go and bring back in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. These people had to sit there and wait for hours.
Yeah, it's prepared as they wait, right? So they have very fresh food.
Yeah.
So he's preparing, he has Sarah prepare these choice cakes, and then he himself runs to the herd. He doesn't just tell his servant, okay, go out and kill a calf or kill a goat, and having it be a calf too, that would be a very choice kind of animal to kill, right? Because you could kill maybe a goat or a sheep, though they're smaller, but a calf, that's an animal that still has a lot of potential to grow up and to offer a lot more food, but a calf, they're very tender and choice meat, but it's really quite a sacrifice to kill a calf.
That's why he's leading me back to, I think, more than the tree, mm-hmm. that there's an entourage, but the mm-hmm. passage only recognizes those key people, mm-hmm. and or maybe it's for them to carry with them mm-hmm. after they leave.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a good point. There's nothing said about more. But they are certainly making a feast that many, many could eat. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm starting to wonder if maybe this is where Abraham starts to see God, because isn't this like somehow reflective of sacrifice?
Yeah.
A certain measure of flour as a sacrifice, a padded calf. I mean, it's starting to sound a little bit like...
Like a sacrifice?
Yeah.
Maybe he's covering his faces.
Well,
he suspects that maybe this could be the Lord, just in case.
Now, if you were offering flour for sacrifice, you would mix it with oil, but you wouldn't knead it and make it into cakes, right? So he's making it into something really nice to eat. Gold cakes. He's making cakes. And not only that, they never offer, if you notice, curds and milk. Curds and milk are never part of the offering, but maybe it is suggested. I don't know. Or we could go the other way and say that
The origins of sacrifice are probably the attempt to feed and nourish the gods. And so you draw on the human food as well. Okay, so he's hastening here. He's running to the herd. He's taking a calf, tender and good. You know, the Hebrew being so spare in its adjectives and so forth, here you have the choice flower, you tender and good, and then he gives it to a servant who hastened to prepare it. Once again, hastening, everyone's hurrying. Although, you're right, this would take a long time to kill the calf, to butcher it, to cook it. And then he supplements this with curds and milk, sets it before them, and waits as they eat. In good Oriental fashion, you don't actually eat with the people that you're serving, but you watch them enjoy their meal first. So he's offered them quite a feast. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that he stood by them. Mm-hmm. They ate. Mm-hmm. He didn't eat with them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Uh-huh.
They're the same.
That would be the servant effect, wouldn't it?
Right.
Mm-hmm. That may be tied in there. I know in some countries and some cultures you eat with the people. We would, because that would sort of signify our community with them, our being with them. But in others, you don't. Does anybody have any experience with that? I know that when we visit some Bosnian friends of ours, they always serve us and they don't eat.
Yeah, that's the way it is down in Appalachia.
I grew up in many first colony.
Eats first? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Is that to ensure that there's enough food for those that eat first?
I don't think so, because there's always plenty of food. It's just a tradition for all happiness. Old Scottish.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
In that little pocket.
I think when you have guests like that, I mean, you want to serve them your very best. You want, you know, and maybe Abraham was filled with the Spirit of the Lord, and maybe he saw the Lord in these three strangers. And, mm-hmm. Fed them the best,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Made them feel good. And you know, I know I was out on an out, and I stayed with this lady in Chelan. And you know, when I go there, I feel like a queen. She just, everything is, you know, I mean, it's just unreal how they treat you. And I think this is what I see here is Abraham just, or, you know, giving him his very best and wanting them to feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Not just give them a few crumbs and send them on their way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that ties into what you were saying about Abraham offering his very best. It ties into some of those passages in Matthew. Matthew 25, 35 about, and 25, 40 about feeding the stranger, and if you've fed one of me, then you've mm-hmm. fed a stranger, then you fed Christ. If you want, we could look up a couple of those, Matthew 25. So this is an example of someone actually, more literally,
uh-huh.
Entertaining
right.
divinity uh-huh. Yeah. By feeding the stranger. Let's just look here, Matthew 25, 35. This is when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him. Then he'll sit on the throne of his glory and all the nations will be gathered before him. They're separating into sheep mm-hmm. and sheep and goats. And then the king, in 34, says, the king will say to those at his right hand, come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And so forth. And then the answer is in 40. And the king will answer them, truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of those poor members of my family, you did it to me. Mm-hmm. So feeding Christ through the stranger. Here, Abraham, as it says in Hebrews, entertaining angels unaware. Which is a beautiful passage too. Beautiful interpretation. In fact, let's look at that right now. This is a classic Christian interpretation of what he did in Hebrews 13. Hebrews 13, 1-2.
Does anybody have that?
Would you like that reading?
Let love for your fellow believers continue and be a fixed practice with you. Never let it fail. Is that what you want? In verse 2?
In verse 2. Mm-hmm.
Do not forget or neglect or refuse to extend hospitality to strangers in the brotherhood, being friendly, cordial, and gracious, sharing the comforts of your home, and doing your part generously. For through it, some have entertained angels without knowing.
Mm-hmm. So some have entertained angels without knowing. Referring back to the Abraham story. Would someone else read another version of that passage? Would you like to? Yeah. Is that the New Revised Standard? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing that, some have entertained angels without knowing it.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So there's a classic interpretation of the Abraham story in the New Testament in Hebrews. Abraham entertaining angels, although unaware. The story continues, and I find this perhaps as interesting as Abraham's reaction to these strangers as they came, because it's not a one-way street at all. He goes out of his way and offers this wonderful banquet to these strangers, and yet they come back and they give him good news. Mm-hmm. So that may echo a number of our experiences as well, as we try to do something good for somebody else and then we realize that the person that we're trying to serve actually ends up serving us. So why don't we look at what happens next, reading 9 to 15.
Where is your wife Sarah? They asked him. There in the tent, he said. Then the Lord said, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, will have a son. Now Sarah was listening at the entrance to the tent, which was behind him. Abraham and Sarah were already too old and well advanced in years, and Sarah was past the age of childbearing. So Sarah laughed to herself as she thought, after I am worn out and my master is old, will I now have this pleasure? Then the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh and say, will I really have a child now that I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? I will return to you at the appointed time next year, and Sarah will have a son. Sarah was afraid, so she lied and said, I did not laugh. But he said, yes, you did laugh.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. What's the translation you're reading from?
New International.
New International? Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Okay, so here the guest, the one that he's been serving, ends up bearing him some very good news. And this is where I think the indications start to come faster that he's dealing not with just ordinary guests, even to him, right? Because they say, where is your wife Sarah? How do they know that her name is Sarah, for one thing?
And then this promise that there's going to be a son as well doesn't seem like a promise that would be given by an ordinary person. And then when Sarah laughs to herself, so she's laughing silently or whatever, and then the Lord says, why is Sarah laughing? So kind of there's a little, in this passage, you start getting these signs that he's not dealing with ordinary folks anymore, that they received this promise, even though they're very old. And Sarah's past menopause, apparently. Ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. She's 90. And she laughs, which might be an appropriate response there. Mm-hmm. Notice that she's not actually in on the party either. She's behind, she's in the tent. So the custom apparently was that the women would remain behind the partition, but she was listening in, so she was part of the whole conversation. She hears this. Sarah's laughter actually echoes Abraham's laughter out loud earlier. When Abraham's told about this, he also laughs out loud in the previous chapter, 17:17.
He fell on his face and laughed.
So he's rather an extroverted laugher here. And here, God assures him, no, your wife Sarah shall bear you a son, and you shall call him Isaac. And Isaac means, actually, he laughs. So there's this this play throughout the chapters on the name of Isaac, which means he laughs. Play on laughter. Laughter with Abraham laughing, laughter with Sarah laughing here to herself, although she's embarrassed that she laughs because she does, really, she thinks it's out of line. And actually, the Lord seems to rebuke her a bit by saying, is anything too wonderful for the Lord? She gets a little harsher treatment than Abraham here for laughing, and she wants to deny it. But later, when her son's born in chapter 21, she laughs out loud for delight. And so that theme of laughter is picked up again. In 21, the Lord dealt with Sarah as he said, and she bore him Isaac, or he laughed. Abraham was 100 years old at the time, and it says in 21:6, now Sarah said, God has brought laughter to me. For everyone who hears will laugh with me. Now here you have laughter of joy after the child is born. So throughout this whole passage, there's this play on the word laughter or play. And it continues, actually, although in a bit more serious bent, because as the child Isaac grows and was weaned in 21:8 forward, Sarah saw Hagar's son Ishmael playing, but that's also laughing with Isaac. So, and she was afraid that Ishmael was going to usurp Isaac's place. So, see, Ishmael shouldn't be laughing because Isaac's the one of laughter, right? So she ends up kicking him out. So, but he does. Ishmael also comes to form a mighty nation as well. So his end isn't as bad as might be indicated. So. Anyway, this child of laughter is promised to them by the guests before they leave. They go on then. Does anybody have any reactions or comments on this section? Yeah.
Question on the mention here. This is the Revised Standard Version. I'm going back to 9. It says, they said to him, and then he says, then one said, I will surely return to you in due season. And it isn't until after Sarah laughs that this version refers to it as the Lord, the capital L.
Mm-hmm.
As if it's at that point after the laughter that The Lord is actually revealing himself. This is a revised standard. But that was an interesting one because I mean, it certainly revealed just by the question knowing her name, but
going back to the previous chapter, it told Abraham that he was going to have a son by Sarah. So that then in 18, when she hears it, maybe she hadn't heard it before. But Abraham had been told before, before he said he
manifested. And even in 15, he's told he's going to have a son as well.
Well, yeah, but in here specifically, he's talking about Sarah. And of course, earlier he had a son who was with her family. Apparently, it wasn't news to Abraham at the time that these three men or angels, whatever they were, appeared to him in the passage in 18. Apparently it wasn't news to him that he was going to have a son. He already knew it. He'd already been told by the Lord. Verse 15 in chapter 17, God said to Abraham, as for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarah, but Sarah, her name shall be, I will bless her and give you a son also of her.
And then Abraham's reaction is to laugh, and God says, no, no, it's really. And then Abraham's reaction, no, please, let it be Ishmael. So I don't think he quite believes it either until it actually happens, but he's still asking, well, you know, Ishmael's a good boy, right? Let it be him. But God says, no, no. Okay. So we don't get his response after all that. But I think that you have a good point there, is that that's another really strong indication where the identity of the company that Abraham is keeping is revealed here. Why did Sarah laugh in 18:13? Why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I indeed bear a child now that I'm old? Is anything too wonderful for the Lord? At the set time, I will return to you. So there seems to be a kind of equivalence there. Is that what you're noting?
The earlier version, or the version that you read, it says the Lord, earlier, the Lord said, I will surely, but in this version, it isn't until later.
Some of these more paraphrastic translations, like yours is more paraphrased and yours is more paraphrased, they're filling in some of the gaps or some of the sketchier parts of the narrative with information from other parts. And it may make it easier to read, but I like that just the simpler translation because it seems to be more complex, and that you can wonder, well, when did he figure this out? When did he start sort of figuring out that he was dealing more with just people? And you can kind of, it gives you little clues along the way. So the story goes on after this with the men setting out after they've had their hospitality that Abraham's offered them, and after they've given this promise to Sarah of the son. And this is rather interesting because notice that Abraham's hospitality doesn't end when they leave his tent. He actually accompanies them for a long way. So he gives them his company for a long way. Why don't we just read through 16 through 21? We'll have to just go quicker now. 16 through 21. Would you like to read?
All right.
Yeah.
Then the men set out from there, and they looked towards Sodom. And Abraham went with them to set them on their way. The Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do, seeing that Abraham shall become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? No, for I have chosen him, that he may charge his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord, by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring about for Abraham what he has promised him. Then the Lord said, how great is the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah, and how very great their sin. I must go down and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me. And if not, I will know.
Okay, thank you. So they're setting out for their further work, setting out towards Sodom. Then Abraham goes with them to set them on their way. So this is also part of his hospitality as he accompanies them for a long distance on their road. And while doing so, once again, he receives something too. He receives this information that Sodom and Gomorrah are going to be destroyed if it's true that their reputation really does signal that they've been doing terrible things. I like this sentence here in 19. The Lord says that he's not going to hide from Abraham what he's going to do because he's chosen him that he may charge his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice. By doing righteousness and justice. So keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice is what Abraham is going to charge all his children. It reminds me of our theme, I guess, is one reason that it leaped out me. Guide our feet in the way of peace. And Abraham is seen here as someone who's going to charge his children and his household to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice. So he was viewed as a very righteous man, and so he has this privy information that Sodom and Gomorrah is going to be destroyed. And after that, you have that the scene where Abraham bargains with God and says, well, you wouldn't destroy it if there are only 50 good people, would you? 45, 40, 30, 20, 10, all the way down to 10. So if there are 10, the Lord agrees with Abraham there. In that section, in 21-22, the men turned from there and went towards Sodom while Abraham remained standing before the Lord. So the mysterious men now depart. Perhaps only two of them depart, because in 19 it's the two angels that are departing, and Abraham's remaining there with the Lord. So here you have the host sort of wrangling with his guests. They give him information of what's to come, and he ends up talking with them, bargaining with them, arguing with them, and convincing the Lord to spare the whole city if only 10 righteous people are found in it. So, although he identifies himself as a servant in his relationship to the three men, still he is not hesitant at all to argue with them and to advocate the saving of the city of even 10 righteous people in all of it. We don't have time to go on to the next chapter, but the next chapter reiterates this theme of hospitality, right? When they, perhaps it's worth reading just the first part, because we have a reiteration of the theme of hospitality with Lot, with the two angels. They come to Sodom in the evening, and the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of Sodom. So once again, sitting out in public, watching people pass, as Abraham was in his tent. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed down with his face to the ground. He said, please, my lords, turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you can rise early and go on your way. And they said, no, we will spend the night in the square. But he urged them strongly, so they turned aside and entered his house, and he made them a feast, and he baked unleavened bread, and they ate. So there he offered hospitality in the same way, some of the same words. It's later at night, apparently, so he offers them a place to stay, and he doesn't go to all the trouble to kill an animal. He bakes quick bread, it's probably late at night, unleavened bread, makes them a feast, and they stay with him. So he's another example of hospitality, but it ends up that the people of Sodom exemplify exactly the opposite unhospitality, because they end up demanding that the two men be turned out so that they can know them, meaning that they can have sexual relations with them. And Lot will not let this happen because he's taken them under his protection as their host, and so he says, yeah, mm-hmm.
That's one point. It's a little troublesome that he offers his daughters.
Right, he offers his daughters, his virgin daughters, which one would think not too highly of, but it's an one positive way of looking at it is it's an indication of how terrible he thinks their demand is to bring out the men. Because, I mean, I don't think he'd be advocating that the men rape his virgin daughters. I think, to me, it's almost like so horrific that he said, well, okay, take the virgin daughters, and they would say no. Maybe they wouldn't, I don't know. But in any case, yeah, it shows the sort of patriarchal hierarchical kind of priorities, I guess. You protect your male guests, even at the expense of your virgin daughters, who you protected all your life, you know, as the head of a family. You wouldn't let that lightly go either. But it does show a certain sort of priority to get to protect the male guests. But in this case, the angels come out and they protect him. But Sodom is destroyed, and Sodom's reputation in later literature is that it was an unhospitable place. It's also seen as sort of a place of fornication or whatever, but it's seen as a place that was inhospitable and was destroyed. So it's kind of a counterbalance, a negative contrast to Abraham's very fine treatment of the men in the previous story. So they sort of stand together as illustrating a positive portrayal of hospitality, and then those that didn't offer hospitality. So it's a bit of a downer to end. But let's emulate Abraham rather than the people of Sodom, for sure, in our dealings.
One more question.
Oh, please.
Did Abraham walk with him for safety? I mean, what did he think that he was? I mean, was that the cultural pattern that the host would walk ways with them to protect them?
I think that would be part of it, mm-hmm. to protect them away, and also just to set them out on their way. Mm-hmm. So he's going, it's an indication of the extent of his hospitality as well. When Jacob meets Esau at the end of that same story, Esau also offers to have some of his men go with them as well, although Jacob declines. Okay.
Thank you,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.